Welcome to the Marketing Millennials, the No BS Marketing Podcast. I'm Daniel Murray, and join me for unfiltered conversations with the brains behind marketing's coolest companies. The one request I tell our guests, stories or it didn't happen. Get ready to turn the fuck up.
How do we start to seed the market ahead of launch? Maybe it's that we know that there's a specific message or a narrative that we want to pull into. Maybe we actually are looking at the roadmap and we see that over the course of 9 months, we're going to be launching a bunch of smaller launches that actually compound to a much larger value story or value narrative. So how do we start to launch those smaller launches into the market, maybe tier three, maybe even a tier two launch, but connect it to the bigger value story so that every single time we're launching value, we're building.
Typeform, forms that break the norm. Get more data like signups, feedback, and anything else with forms that are designed to be refreshingly different. Learn more and get started for free at typeform.com. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Marketing Millennials. Today, I have a special type of episode. I have three people joining me on the podcast. There's a reason for three of them. They have their own podcast ready for launch that just launched. And I'll let Tamara kick it off and say how Tamara, Jason, and Andy all met and how they all product marketers. And then we can get into everybody's individual stories after that.
Sure. So, you know, the world of product marketing is smaller than you might think. And so actually, Andy, Jason, and I all knew each other individually, especially on LinkedIn and at some of the product marketing conferences. It's hard not to know each other. We'd comment on each other's posts. And eventually, we all started to become friends. And we would get on calls to help each other. We'd say, hey, what are you thinking about this? Can I get your perspective on this campaign I'm working on? And the more and more that we got to know each other, the more that we realized that all three of us had really unique strengths. And we all had this shared passion for product launches, which I think a lot of product marketers do. But Andy comes, I won't ruin the surprise for you, Andy, but Andy comes from a competitive background. I've been a product marketing leader and really advocate for like the strategic side of product marketing. And then Jason has been a founding PMM so many times, he just has nailed the executional part. And so we started to kind of like bring all of our special sauce together, and that led to Ready for Launch, which originally actually started as a course that we offer. It's a cohort-based course. We have our next cohort coming up shortly here. And then we had such great response from the course and some of the content we were creating on LinkedIn that we ended up creating a pod where we essentially break down product launches live, which is super fun. Yeah, I don't know. Jason, do you want to share a little bit about like your path and kind of what you contribute to our crew?
So yeah, like Tamara said, I've always been a founding PMM. So when I first got into product marketing, I was coming from CS. So like I'd had a career, started my career in sales, then did customer success. And so when I was first asked to do product marketing, even though I was kind of building and running the product marketing function, I'd never done it before. So it was it seems like, how could that be? But it's actually really common. And so with this founding PMM role, it's often a lot of people who are stepping in and given a lot of responsibility, and they've never actually done half of it before. And so it's a challenging role to be in. And so I spent my career doing that. So at three different companies, starting as the first product marketer and building it from there. And so today I'm a coach for other founding product marketers, and I work with earlier stage startups as a consultant, just figuring out this product marketing thing when it's so new for their company. And yeah, that's me. I have a newsletter too. It's called PMM Files. And, or I share like practical product marketing examples, but yeah, and then I do this course with these guys. So that's me. But yeah, Andy, what about you?
So I'm Andy. I have had, a few jobs now where I've been building competitive intel programs for companies. And so I was at ZoomInfo, ClickUp, Apollo now doing competitive intel stuff. And over that period of time, I realized, oh my God, there's like no resources out there for this profession. Everyone's like keeping everything close to the chest. No one's really like talking about how they're going about it. And so I put together a community newsletter and podcast called Healthy Competition, which is all just about evangelizing the role of competitive intel or product marketers that are doing competitive intel and just sharing tips and tricks, stuff like that. And so as part of that, I interviewed Tamara once, I interviewed Jason once, and that was another way that we all kind of learned about each other. And yeah, like Tamara mentioned, like at one point she recommended, like, we should all be like talking more often. We kind of thought like, not just about product marketing, but our individual like creator businesses and whatnot. And so that spun out into Ready for Launch, to the course, into the podcast. And so, yeah, it's been a blast learning from these two.
That's awesome. I love when marketers come together all with this in the same profession, but different skill sets. And that's cool to see. But I want to direct the first question at Jason. And I know on your podcast, Ready for Launch, you tear down product launches and share what made them successful. What are the ingredients for a good product launch?
So I'll try to be like specific, kind of tactical here. So there are a few things. So in total, I have a list here of about seven. So one is just like a clear goal or objective. A lot of times you're going to like, if you're thinking of a launch, and there could be different sizes and tiers and all that, but if you're thinking of a launch, you should have a clear goal, objective. Like, what are you trying to achieve with this launch? Could it be driving increased adoption in your product? Could be a pipeline goal? Could it be it's something that you know is going to help you expand within your existing customer base? All of that. So having like a clear goal, key like measurable results that you're hoping to drive from the launch is kind of step number one, or at least one of the main things you need. The other is a clear target. So Tamara preached on this one a lot. You need to know who you're targeting with your launch. So the more specific, the more clear you can be on an ICP, the better. That then leads into your positioning, right? So positioning being, how are you the best at solving a problem for a specific person or group of people? And so when you're thinking about your launch, you're getting clear on the positioning for that particular product, feature, that sort of thing that you're launching. One that I would call a narrative, but it's just this like, so what behind the launch? Like, what's the story behind this launch? Why should people care? Why should they tune in to what you're launching? And so having that story that you're trying to tell is an important one. Distribution, I think, is one that's often kind of forgotten about. So people will be like, oh, we're launching, we're going to do all the things, we're going to launch it on LinkedIn. But if you don't have a distribution channel that is actually a mature, effective distribution channel, you're putting it out there and no one's going to listen. So I think knowing what your primary distribution channels are going to be, is it email? Is it you're going to use Product Hunt because you've invested time in building your audience there? Is it LinkedIn? Is it going to be events? Like, knowing what your distribution channels are and like focusing on the ones that are going to have the most impact. And then enablement. If you've got a sales team, if you've got like, there's both the sales enablement and the buyer enablement side, but if you've got a sales team, like if you're very sales led, or if you are product led and you're like CS kind of team that helps take people to success and you know, expand them and so on. If they don't know how to talk about this launch and they don't know how to describe the value of your product to people, then it's not going to be successful. So Andy, Tamara, like, I don't know if I missed anyone there, but that's kind of the list that came to mind for me.
I want Andy to go a little bit into how to assess and determine competitive differentiation at a product level for a product launch level and how this will impact the strategy.
In my experience, you know, you have to have a good handle on both competitive intelligence and market intelligence in order to put together a launch strategy. And one thing to clarify just before going much deeper, because I'm sure tons of people listening have heard those quotes from Jeff Bezos or Jack Ma that are talking about how you shouldn't pay attention to competitors. You should really only pay attention to customers. And the reality is those are great sound bites. They're great little tidbits to put on LinkedIn to get a bunch of engagement. But this mindset is actually really not considerate to most buyers and their experience. It's really like the equivalent of like plugging your ears and covering your eyes and hoping for the best. The average buyer is evaluating 3 to 5 vendors in a given category before actually making a purchase decision. And if you look at market landscapes from G2, Forrester, or the MarTech Weekly, you'll notice that just about every single category is just absolutely flooded with competition. So if you don't think about this stuff, you're really risking looking and sounding just like exactly the same as dozens of other vendors, which we don't want that, right? You know, we want to differentiate. We want to stand out. We want our buyers to remember us and think of us. We have to have a good handle on that stuff for those reasons, but it's also really important, right, from a launch perspective, because this intelligence fuels the entire rest of our launch strategy, product development, messaging, sales enablement,
like literally just about everything. And so that's why I always try to start with competitive intel and market intel. And when I'm gathering that kind of stuff, it's really important to know that not all activities are equal, right? There's some high value stuff and there's some low value stuff. You know, what I would consider low value activities is mostly like scraping press releases, social media. There's nothing inherently wrong with them. It's just not super helpful, right? Press releases are usually put together by competitors to sound as polished up, as professional as possible. It's marketing at the end of the day. And so it's highly biased. And it's tricky to find really valuable information there. Social media is kind of similar. Yeah, you might find some valuable information, but at the end of the day, it's tough to find exactly what you're looking for. In the middle tier level of value, you can think of things like annual reports and website content. Again, just to clarify, none of this information is like really bad, but you have to think of it in the context of like why you're looking for competitive information. It's not just to understand a company's financial strategy. It's to understand how their competing product works and other customers' opinions of it. Now, the highest tier of value are really customer and prospect interviews, knowledge center articles, and analyst reports. Those are the resources that have like the least fluff and they're most rich in terms of detail and relevance to your launch. And so hopefully that gives folks a good jumping off point to start when they're putting together a launch strategy.
I think that's great because it's like playing a sport. I'll just give an analogy of sports because I played sports, but it's like, oh, I'm going to go play this team, but don't worry, I'm not going to look at what they did in the past. I'm just going to run my own game plan. And if it works against them, it works. But I don't care who I'm playing. I don't care what defense they're on. I don't care if there's new rules in the rule book in the industry. I'm just going to go play my game. And if we win, we win. And if we lose, we lose. Like, I'm just going to focus on the people that are in the room, which is a terrible strategy in like sports and life. I think obsessing over competitors and being scared of them is different than having all the information to go out and run your best game. And that's the two different paths you can go down.
I was in the same situation. Like, I played high school sports, so I wasn't like you where I was playing like D1 football. Okay. So like comparing myself is not really equal, but even still, like, we were watching tape of the teams that we were going to be playing like in the next week, like, oh, this, like evaluating strengths and weaknesses and like what they have versus what we don't have and figuring out ways that we can like position ourselves in the best place to win. So that's a great analogy. Totally.
How do you choose specific personas you should do for launch? Should you be launching products to your entire customer base or subsegment? How do you choose what personas to go after?
Early on, when you're running maybe your first launch, maybe your second launch, it can be so tempting to think, I need to tell everyone about every launch. And as a product marketer, you're probably going to get a lot of pressure from your CEO, the executives, head of product, who are like, this product's for everyone. Everyone needs to know everything that we're building. And the reality is, just as there's a difference between like obsessing over your customers or being aware, there's a difference between notifying your customers that something exists and actually running a launch campaign to them. And so for me, it's like, there's nothing wrong with notifying customers. We can notify them in app or via, you know, sometimes companies will have like a newsletter every month, like a product updates. That's fine. I actually don't consider that launch. When I talk about launch, and I think when we talk about launch on the show, we are talking about launch campaigns, right? These are larger launches that have a strategic narrative, as Jason mentioned. And so for me, a lot of this work in determining what is the best audience for this launch campaign comes out of the work that Andy mentioned. So we've understood what our competitive differentiator is and for whom we are different and more compelling, right? And so as part of that, that's looking at data in our own customer base to say, if we have existing segments today, which segment are we really building for? Ideally, we're actually doing this work with the product management team while we're building the product. Not always the case. So it might be that we get the product, we're ready to build a launch plan, and we actually need to add that level of granularity. And so I like to start by asking the question, what are we trying to drive with this launch? Are we trying to drive acquisition? Are we trying to drive engagement? Are we trying to reduce churn? And that is going to be a good indicator of who you should be going after, because if you're trying to drive acquisition, it's going to be a very market heavy, market facing launch. If you're trying to mitigate churn, well, you're probably almost entirely launching just the segments of your customer base, probably segments who are high risk. And so it's a little bit an art and science here of determining what is the right segment, what is the right KPI that we're trying to drive with launch, and is this segment large enough that we can actually influence that KPI?
I mean, Jason said it at first, for everything starts with that goal or KPI that you want to go after. And I do like the clarification, because some people just think like, oh, I'm going to launch my product, I already have a distribution channel, like, let me just blast it to everybody that I have a new feature or a new segment on my product. And it goes deeper than that. I mean, for some features that might be there, like, oh, we just increased the speed of our product, like, it might be a little bit like, we don't care that much. But if it's like something that's like solving a huge pain point, then you need to start thinking bigger than just like notifying people that it exists. But I also want to ask you another quick follow-up question, Tamara. I know that every product launch requires a pricing strategy, but how do you decide if this is basically an add-on, an upsell to the existing product, or a bundle for a product? How do you deciding, and does everything need a pricing strategy?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think a lot about this. I think you need to always ask yourself if your product launch needs a pricing strategy. And not always, right? There may be a tier 4 small improvement, and it's actually not net new value. But if you are releasing net new value, I think you should be thinking about how you're pricing and packaging that value. And there's a couple things to consider. The first one is, again, back to the goal. What are we trying to do with this new feature or this new value that we're releasing? Or if we gave it to everyone, would it like fundamentally improve the quality of our product? Would it mean that like we're going to be able to reduce churn for everyone? And sometimes the trade-off is worth it, that you're like, yeah, give it to everyone for free, because it's actually like a fundamental thing that everyone needs. Sometimes it's a great opportunity to drive expansion revenue or upsell revenue. And maybe there's a small group of people who want it. And so one of my favorite tools, and we talk about this actually in our course, is called the feature value matrix. And so there's almost two components to this. I'm going to walk you through it. It's complicated, but I'm going to try to simplify it. So essentially, you need to determine two different things. The first one is you need to determine feature preference. So of the feature that you're bringing to market, or maybe it's like a whole new product line with multiple features within itself, what features do your target segment, and we're not going to be surveying and interviewing everyone here, but for your target segment, what features do they prefer and not prefer? And we're going to do it not via stack rank. We're actually going to do like a trade-off feature preference. It's called max diff. So we're going to ask them, out of the list of features, which one do they want the most and which one do they value the least? And we're going to get a really interesting chart as a result of that. That's going to make it super clear where the value is kind of placed. Then separately, we're going to actually test willingness to pay for those individual features or for your product once it has those net new features in it. There's a couple different ways we can test willingness to pay. The Gaber Granger and the Van Westendorp are two of my favorites. I think if you've not done a pricing survey before, a Van Westendorp is a really great place to start because it's super simple. We're basically going to ask four questions. At what price would this be like so expensive you would not buy? At what price would this be getting expensive but you'd still buy? At what price would this be like such a good deal? And then at what price would the price be so low you'd actually like question the quality of the product and you wouldn't want to buy it? And then we're going to get two really interesting data points. We're going to have a price point that people probably want to pay for it. You're also going to have some features that people prefer. But when you overlay those two data sets together, and the guys have seen this because we show a couple examples, it becomes really cool. And you're basically going to be able to place all of your features into one of four quadrants: a table stakes quadrant, a differentiators quadrant, an add-ons quadrant, and like a wasteland quadrant. And basically what you're going to be able to do is make some really smart decisions about both positioning and pricing. So anything in table stakes, you probably want to include in the core value proposition, but also your core package. Anything in differentiator, that's an opportunity for you to use that as a differentiator from a positioning perspective, but also potentially either price it separately or include it in a higher package to get people to move up package or to increase the ARPU of your customer who's willing to pay for that. Then the add-on bucket is really interesting because this is essentially people who have a high preference for this, very few people have a high preference for it, but the people who do have a high preference are very much willing to pay for it. And so if we actually included those in all of our regular packages, we might be deterring people from buying the product because they might feel like they're overpaying. And so we offer those as add-ons so that the people who do want it, they'll pay whatever the willingness to pay was for it. So that was a bit of a long answer, but that's kind of my favorite way to approach pricing, especially for something like a tier one or a tier two launch.
No, it totally makes sense because it affects like that enablement pack thing that Jason said at the beginning. Because for example, like, is an add-on would be more that account management is dealing with. If it's bundled or a new differentiator, that's more of a sales team marketing type thing that you're dealing with. And if it's wasteland, that it means it probably should be free in the product anyway. So don't even like talk about it really. I mean, you maybe can mention it like that kind of that product newsletter, like, hey, we're adding this on there, but it's not always going to pay for this. It's just kind of making the product better. So it's good to know all these things. So you actually have a go-to-market approach. And also like product launches, the go-to-market approach doesn't always have to be like, hey, we're publicly saying this. Like it could be like an internal thing to customers. It's like,
exactly. And it might even be that different segments, say this is a tier one launch and it's a major piece of new value. Maybe it's a whole product line. Maybe you've acquired a product and you're integrating it. The reality is you probably have multiple customer segments for this launch. It's not just one segment. And so what we do is we run this feature value matrix for all those segments. And we can see, hey, for segment A, this is what they prefer. Let's make the messaging about that. For segment B, this is what they prefer. Let's make the messaging about that. And so you can start to make, you know, maybe on the homepage of the website or on the product page of the website, it's a bit more high level. It's a bit more tailored to everyone that would buy your product. But in your customer campaigns, you can actually get very specific and tailored. And the rest of the world doesn't necessarily need to know the language you used for that particular customer.
Jason, I have a question for you because I know one of the biggest pain points for product marketers is that product teams just build a product and they say, hey, you guys market it. You figure out how to launch this. But I know you probably have a different answer for what I'm going to ask you, but how early in the product, like the product launch, should you be involved in there? And then also, like, should you even be involved earlier before like that product is even starting to be developed?
I would say the status quo for product marketers today is like you're involved to probably too late in the process. Like later on, it's basically this product is done. It's about ready to ship. Hey, can we launch this, product marketer? Like we're launching it next week. Can you come in and help us with some marketing material? And so a lot of it depends on this, like how much, at what point, how early or how much lead time a product marketer needs really does depend on the size of the launch. And I think its size is really, that's all based on how, like the impact of the launch, right? And so Tamara talked about this idea of tiering. And so depending on the size of the launch, typically it's going to mean that there are certain expectations that come with it in terms of like what type of preparation you need, like how much enablement is required. Do you need pricing? Like does it impact pricing? Do we need time to figure that out and time to train people? So a lot of that will dictate how much lead time you actually need as a product marketer. I think if you're working on a tier one, for example, I would say like anyone probably in SaaS, you need like 3 to 6 months, I would say, to like properly plan for that type of launch. But there could be a tier three, tier four launch where, you know, a couple weeks beforehand and you need time, like, I think it's somewhat realistic. You might have, that might be enough time to pull things together. In terms of where a product marketer should strive to be involved in the process, like I think the more the product marketers can get, you know, it's almost like the product development and the product marketing, like launch process, are like these two tracks that kind of, you know, today it's like the product marketing one starts at the end of the product development one. The more that you can pull the product marketing one up a bit, where the product marketer is starting to do the stuff Andy's talking about, where it's understanding the market and the competitive landscape, maybe around the time when a product team is starting to do discovery or trying to do some discovery around like, what are the problems that exist in our customer base? What should we actually build? The more the product marketing can get involved, even around that discovery phase, to be like, hey, this is a gap in the market that we could fill, like helping to shape what that feature, what that product might look like. Or a lot of product marketers would argue, hey, can we be involved from the jump and actually help influence the roadmap in terms of what goes on the roadmap? So I think in an ideal world, product marketing, product management would work together to be like, what should the roadmap look like based on what kind of gaps exist in the market? Where could we differentiate if we were able to build our product in this direction? But yeah, I think it's anyone watching this who's in product marketing, it's like take baby steps to get earlier in that process and get involved more in that product development process, even as a start, just to be aware of what steps are involved and then try to look for ways where you can add value. And then eventually you'll get earlier and earlier.
More ways to grow your business with Typeform. Collect more and better data with forms that embed where people see them. From web to email, Typeform can help you ask the right questions at the right time to reveal deeper insights about your customers and prospects. Learn more and get started for free at typeform.com. What is your strategy for tier-based product launches? And then how do you like determine and prioritize resources for all these things? Because obviously they could be multiple things that happen and you can have like tier one, tier two, tier three. And every company I've been to, people want to go faster than you would like them to do. So what's the strategy behind it all?
So when we talk about launch tiers, it's based on the concept that like not every launch is created equal, right? Not every launch is the same level of importance. If everything you launched, you made the same amount of noise around it and everything was as important as the next, eventually people would just kind of become numb to it. It would be noise, and the ones that really mattered wouldn't have the same amount of impact. So you should have some type of methodology to prioritize your launches. One is to make sure that you can, to your point, Dan, like the workload, how do you balance your workload and make sure that you're not just having two tier ones in a month or like a tier one launch every month? And the other is to manage too, like how much impact you can actually drive from a launch. Because to my point before, it's like if everything's the same, then eventually you're going to have diminished returns. And so the point of a launch tiering, it's a prioritization framework so that a P1, like a top tier, would be your most important, the most impactful, the one that's going to need the most lead time. It's going to have hopefully the most impact. And a tier four or a P4, which is going to be kind of not even really a launch. It's just releasing it. It's not necessarily putting a launch behind it. And the framework that I really like for how to determine and score these and determine what goes where or where it falls, Mark Cassini, who's another product marketer, works at a company called Jobber. He recently came up with a framework where it asks two questions. So one is, what's the customer value? The other is, what's the business value? So you ask yourself, is this high customer value, meaning a customer signs up to use your product because they're trying to drive some type of impact or they have some type of objective? To what extent is this new feature or product going to help them achieve that? So is it really valuable for the customer? The other is going to be, is it valuable for the business? So is it going to help us drive revenue? To what extent is it going to help us drive our particular objective too? So if it's high on both, that's great. It's probably a P1. If it's low on both, probably a P4. General like type range there. And the important thing when you're starting to think of your different tiers is every tier should have some level of expectations that come with it. So what are our typical go-to-market efforts that we use here? Which one of these is, does it go from being just a customer launch to being, okay, now we're going to talk to the market? What level of enablement goes with this type of launch? How much lead time do we need? How much budget do we get? Who's typically involved? All those things. So that one big one is like balancing. You can set some expectations where we can only do one P1 per quarter, things like that. So that when you start to plan out your launches for like your roadmap for the year, you can start to balance where you're like, okay, we can't have two P1s in this quarter. We're going to have to move that one to next quarter. And you can also start to look for ways where you can bundle. You can start to look for all these different opportunities where you can start to like package things together.
One of the things that are so important about this is because you can create like a system, you can get everyone to agree to the system and almost take like the bias out of the launch. And so most companies have multiple product managers, maybe multiple product lines, multiple streams of a roadmap. And it can get really easy as a product marketer to feel like each PM is asking for priority for their launch. But if you kind of as a collective unit, like this should not be done in isolation, just the PMM team. But if the PM team and the PMM team all agree on the criteria for what would make all of these tier one, tier two, tier three, as well as how much effort and resources and budget we would allocate to it, then it becomes super easy to just work together to say, hey, what's on the roadmap the next quarter? Let's all tier this together based on the criteria. And it's not, you know, the loudest person in the room gets the most resources. It's not, well, I love this project. I like keep hearing from customers that everyone wants it. It's like, I don't know, Jason, if you agree, or but in my experience, this has been one of the best benefits of it.
This should be like a shared process. Your product should feel like it was part their idea, part of your idea, versus if you just do this in a vacuum, and then you go to product and try to just say, hey, here's this process we're going to use from now on, it's not going to work.
I want to get Andy's take on this because, like, so if you don't know the competitive market and internally you tier things like you're tiering, how do you determine that, like, okay, this could be valuable to the customer? How do you balance this is valuable to the customer, but it's also a differentiator in the market? Because I think that those could be competing things. Like, I know you said, Jason, like bringing more business value. One of the things that bring more business value is also that you're differentiated in the market and your product's different. Like something that you can bring a cool feature into the market or a cool add-on or a cool thing, but it could be exactly the same as your competitors. Are you really still fighting your competitors? So how do you, Andy, in this tier strategy, help the tiering and weave in this competitive and data that you've collected to make sure that where we're heading business value-wise is differentiated better than the customer? And then we can also lay in better messaging in each tier launch.
It's super important to talk about differentiation, and we always want to be different. The important thing to remember here is that, yeah, like we do want to stand out, but we also need to make it clear how similar we are to some of our category leaders, especially for like those up and coming startups. And here's why, right? It's a delicate balance. Why do you want to be similar? Well, it's one of the biggest channels for growth and new customers is poaching them from your competitors. And the hardest thing for a lot of your customers is actually just leaving. It's a pain in the butt. Nobody really wants to leave and like do something different. And like they're not going to leave, change their entire workflow, do a bunch of migration for 3 months just for a product that's even like 20% better. In a lot of cases, they need it to be like significantly better. And so it really depends on your position, right? Again, we want to be different, but in a lot of cases, you might find a lot of value in being similar, being really easy to use, and having a great migration process away from that competitor so that people can use some of your smaller, more differentiated features that they might find really valuable. Again, this is really true, especially for like the more like well-established categories that, again, there's a bunch of category leaders. You might be an up-and-comer. So yes, being different is super, super important. I don't want to like take away from that. But I do think that sometimes we overlook the importance of sometimes being similar and making sure that we can like ground everyone's perspective from like, oh yeah, we can be an actual alternative for this other category leader. We have all the things that you know and love about that tool, but we approach some of these other aspects a little bit differently and we think for the best. So that's something to kind of keep in mind. And the other thing that is really important to keep in mind too is, you know, I was talking with Jason and Tamara about this the other day, but like so many launches aren't differentiators. There are plenty of launches where it's like, no, it's like an integration with Salesforce or something like that. You know what I mean? Like you can't just constantly be churning out differentiated feature here like every single month. Like it's crazy to be expecting that. And so much of differentiation I've found that like really work, like when it works, it really works, is in the delivery. And again, this all is encompassed under competitive and market intel too. Like, what are people used to? Like when they are given a new product launch or they're like being pushed like this new feature or whatever, how can we go against the grain a little bit and stand out a little bit more? We've seen this with a bunch of different companies now. I think one that kind of comes to mind for me was, it was a company, Gong. I'm sure most people are familiar with them, but they released a sales engagement product not too long ago called Gong Engage. And this is not a new, like, crazy feature, right? It is like there is a sales engagement category, there are category leaders. And so them coming out with it, it's like not super differentiated, but their messaging was very differentiated in that they were saying, like, it was like last to market or first. What was it again, Tamara?
Basically, the whole message was like they learned from everyone else's mistakes, right? And they have like a whole manifesto about it.
It was unique because normally you come out to market and you're like, oh, we're the only ones that have this, yada, yada, yada. But they took a little bit of a different approach and it stuck out to me because, you know, I'm familiar with the space and I was like, oh, that's okay. I got it. And so like now it gets into the mind of someone who's like in the space and all that kind of stuff. So in either case, yes, it's important to differentiate. Sometimes you have to go outside of like the actual like product lens though. And you need to think, okay, how can we differentiate from like a channel perspective, how we're like talking to customers, maybe from like a promotional perspective. We want to throw like a video behind this or like we want to launch it on Product Hunt. You know what I mean? Like there's a lot of different ways that you can differentiate outside of just like leaning on like capabilities. Because if you do that, you're going to get really stuck and it's going to be really hard to stand out consistently.
When people think of like product differentiation, they always think of the product, but it could be, are we differentiating through like the distribution channels we're going through, the messaging we're going through? And I think Andy talked about all this. Like, is our customer service better than them? Like, are internal things better than them? Do we have like a better bundle than them? Is our pricing different than them? Like, there's so many different factors than the product that could be. And then also like, is it easy to leave this person? Or can we do a campaign that's like, we'll buy out your contract and blah, 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 like people do. Like there's so many different things. If we do something similar-ish to a customer, we could work on a strategy of how we want to bring those new customers or take those customers away. So I love that you mentioned that it could be a similar thing. Like some people could have not went with you 3 months ago because you didn't have an integration with Salesforce. And now you have an integration with Salesforce. So how are you going to manage that?
Exactly. Yeah. And you might keep track of who says no for what specific reasons. And then once you add that feature, you know, reach back out to those people, do a specific campaign if it's a large enough audience. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of different ways that you can go about it. So as long as you branch out a little bit from that product specific mindset, there's a lot of different directions you can go.
It's also, I think, your work that you're doing could be like passed on to product development and be like, actually, the market, based on all the competitors we've heard, the Salesforce integration is probably the number one reason why people are choosing us over our competitors. So maybe we shouldn't prioritize this feature. We should prioritize this one because of the work you've done doing the competitive analysis. And this is why it's so important to do the know what the landscape is so you can tell your product team, like, actually, you guys are going down the wrong direction with this. We're actually losing a lot more deals because we just don't have an integration with Salesforce. So just throwing out that.
I forget if it was Tamara or Jason. In our course, one of you had a flow chart that showed like where you overlap with product marketing versus product. And like that market research and competitive and market intel, that's one of those areas for sure that like you need both teams need to have a solid handle on the market and competitors in order to build a great product, be differentiated, but also be similar enough to where you can stand on your own and take customers from other competitors. But then there are some areas where it's like, okay, we've got it from here. We're going to keep going. We're going to launch this thing.
You all use a term on the show, and I want to direct this to Tamara, Rolling Thunder launch. And I wonder if you guys, Tamara, you could talk a little bit of like, what is a Rolling Thunder launch? Because I mean, I'm not a product marketer. I had no idea that's even a word. I felt like learning new Gen Z slang when you said that. But you tell me what that means.
Sure. I love it. I'm happy I got to teach you something, Daniel. Okay. The concept of Rolling Thunder kind of is in direct comparison to how products used to be launched. Products used to be launched on launch day, right? And so we'd work for months. As Jason said, maybe it's a tier one launch. We've been working 3 to 6 months on this. It's launch day. We're throwing everything that we've got at it. And then it's like day two and nothing happens. It's like, well, launch day is over. And regardless of the results, regardless of the impact, the feedback, we're not really iterating. And so the concept of rolling thunder is just like you kind of hear rolling thunder in the background in a thunderstorm. It starts at a distance and then it gets louder, right? And it kind of picks up steam as the thunderstorm progresses. And so it's this concept of how do we start to seed the market ahead of launch? Maybe it's that we know that there's a specific message or a narrative that we want to pull into. Maybe we actually are looking at the roadmap and we see that over the course of 9 months, we're going to be launching a bunch of smaller launches that actually compound to a much larger value story or value narrative. Great. So how do we start to launch those smaller launches into the market, maybe tier three, maybe even a tier two launch, but connect it to the bigger value story so that every single time we're launching value, we're building, right? The thunder is getting louder and louder. People cannot deny the message that we're telling them. And it's all about this idea of iteration, being agile. And I'll also say responding to how the market and customers respond to you. So I'll give an example. Obviously, we do all the work we can as a product marketer to build the best hypothesis about like, who's this for? How do we position and package that value? But we don't always get it right. And we don't actually really know until it goes out in market. And so maybe we launch something and the first week of launch, we're starting to see, well, we did okay, but actually there's this group of our customers that really responded. They're the early adopters. Like they're adopting this feature in app way faster than anyone else. Wow, we like didn't know that. Now there's an opportunity to do an adoption campaign to other customers in the base that look just like them. Or maybe you look and say, hey, here's the segment, or maybe here's the qualities of this customer who is adopting this launch. How do we go find more of them out in the market and now enable our sales team or our marketing team to build a campaign around that? We didn't know we needed to build a campaign before launch day. So how could we have predicted that? And then that's going to help build an even louder thunder. And so that's where it comes from, that concept. But I think a lot of the launches that we appreciate as a launch crew, if I can call ourselves that, are these really thoughtful rolling thunder launches that seem to happen over time. I think the Canva AI launch was another great example of this. Canva AI, they were slowly dripping AI functionality in app over many, many months. And then it kind of gets you curious about it too, because from a customer perspective, you're like, what is this? Tell me more about this. And you're able to engage with it as well. And so by the time that they've launched a whole AI suite and now they're ready to charge for it in a different way, you as a customer are already totally bought into that value as well. So there's tons of benefits of a Rolling Thunder launch, but that's basically the concept in a nutshell.
Well, I love it because I think one of the strongest forces in marketing is finding points of momentum. And the problem with a lot of launches is if like you get a lot, like a one, just one like loud thunder and nothing coming up to it is just like, you can lose that momentum so fast because nobody will care. But if you doing these little tests along the way, you can find points of momentum where you can keep that going for a long time. And I think the best companies are the ones who just know how to keep on the train of momentum with everything, the launch, then the post-launch, then like keeping that momentum from the launch forever and ever, just because once you've lost momentum, it's hard to gain back momentum in marketing and anything in sports and everything. Once you've lost momentum, it's hard to find a re-spark that. It's better to find the momentum, places of momentum. And I think this is a good question for Jason, because a lot of people treat a release as a launch and it has no momentum. So what is the difference between like a release and a launch?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, and we've kind of touched on this tiny bit throughout in different points, but release and launch should be considered as two different things. They're often kind of lumped together. And so people think just naturally, oh, we're releasing a product. All right, launch on the same day sort of thing. And knowing that they're two completely different terms, a release is more of like a product engineering term. It's like deploying a product. putting the code live, pushing it to production, making sure, you know, features now available for people to see and use, or a product is now available just for people to sign up for and use, sort of thing. Whereas a launch should be thought of as more of a go-to-market event. It's meant to drive value for your business or your customer, meaning that you can have a product live in your app, but if a customer doesn't know the value of it, they don't know how to use it, they don't really know what it is, it's not very likely it's going to drive value for them. Same thing goes for your business. If people don't understand why they should sign up for your product, if people in your company don't understand how to explain it, it's not very likely it's going to drive a lot of revenue for your business. And so that's kind of the difference between the two. A couple of things, like when you're thinking of releases, like the one thing to realize, or one of the things to realize, is that not all releases need a launch. So you could have some things that are released into your product that aren't going to drive a lot of customer and business value. And so they don't need a launch. You can also delay them. So you could have a release, something that's releasing your product, like to tomorrow talking about the Canva launch, things that you're releasing into the product and you're making available, but you don't actually launch it or make it part of a launch until a much later date, because, and this would be the third thing, is that you can bundle releases into one bigger launch. So even to Andy's point before, where it's like you want to differentiate with this launch, one feature alone, it might be like table stakes, like everyone might have it. But if you wait, and then you also, you have this other feature coming out in a couple of months that is actually going to, when they're paired together, you've got like a differentiated story you can tell here. This is actually going to drive more impact because it allows you to have something that helps you position your company as the only company that can do X, Y, and Z. And so you might want to save that up so you can release them into the product. Then you make them part of a much bigger tier one launch later on. So I think that the more that product and product marketing can get aligned on the definitions of a release and a launch, I think it make for much better launches and go to marketing companies. And yeah, but I think today, like, a lot of people think of the same thing.
I like how like Apple does it. Like, you get like these push notifications, like, oh, like, update your phone, like, this is a new like release. But then in their big like festival that they have, it's like, right, oh, iOS 14.8 is the newest thing ever. Like, right, you guys will love this one. But you already had like 14.1, 14.2 that have like trickled out. But they save like the coolest stuff for that part. But right, it's still been just like slowly trickling for months. Like, oh, this is new. You get some PR articles out there like, why you should be doing this, because it's for your security. Why you should be. But then the actual launch was like, oh, you could do these cool things. The interface is different. Like, yeah, it's kind of what I'm thinking about when I think about that.
Founders are usually pretty hesitant to put processes like this in place. And it depends on the size of the company. But I find a lot of times startups are like, we don't want to put too much red tape and too much process because it's going to slow us down. And I think that a lot of times this type of process can actually allow you to move fast while making sure that launches have more impact. Because it's not to say you can't release products. It's not to say you can get things into the product and learn from it and test things out. It's saying that if you think of a release as something that can happen separate of a launch, then it actually allows both teams to move at the pace that they want to move, which I think is like a good clarification for a lot of people who feel like, oh, we have to like wait and tier our launches and bundle them and wait to, like, I don't want to move that slow.
I like the way you explained it, because I think also sometimes you don't want to make noise about something, even though like it could be cool, but sometimes it doesn't need noise. Sometimes you just want it to be testing in the background and you don't want other people to know about it. And sometimes you've known that you want to make noise because it is actually different. Because I've seen so many companies release like something cool and it's like, is this really cool? So it's just like, yeah. So I think that's a good point. I want to ask everybody, because I know we're coming up with time, but I'll start with Andy. What is a marketing hill you would die on?
Ooh, it's just that everyone has a competitor. And one of the most common things I hear, especially this is like a founder CEO kind of a thing, but they'll be like, oh, we are like the only ones that can do XYZ. Like, we have no competitors. We're the best, whatever. And like, even if you are creating a category, you have competitors. There are alternatives to what you offer. Even if it's like a spreadsheet, even if it's like a Google Doc, like, there are alternatives for just about everything. And so that would be my hill that I would die on. Like, everybody has competitors. And so you have to figure out, okay, how are those competitors being used? How widely used are they? how popular, how well known are they? And then if you know that stuff, then you'll be much more successful when you're building your business.
I like that. I think also like we're the only one who does this. I mean, maybe some customer just wants a part of that, and who cares that you're the only one who does that? So I do. I love that. I'll go to tomorrow. What's your EO? I think I know your EO, but you could tell everybody.
I've said my hill so many times. So for me, my marketing hill that I'll die on is that product marketing is not marketing. Although I have come up with a second one because I knew that I was going to get asked this today. So I'm going to do a launch themed hill. And so my launch theme marketing hill that I will die on is that launch is not a single date in time. This goes to the Rolling Thunder. Launch is, I love what you said, like launch is moments of momentum. Launch is not a single day. That's my hill.
So mine's a little bit more general product marketing, but it would be, I think a lot of times product marketers are either afraid of, or they don't feel like it puts product marketing in the right light when they say that you need to be really loved by the sales team. So I think that product marketing can provide a ton of value, but also get a ton of value from being embedded and very, very tight with sales. So it's not to say that you are going to be a service center for the sales team and that you are a coin operated, give me this piece of collateral. But I do think that by being very close to sales, or at least to revenue. So if you're a sales-led organization, product marketing should be very close to revenue, and they should be very close to the sales team. If you're more like PLG, be very close to wherever revenue kind of, wherever rubber meets the road to sort of thing on revenue, which could be like CS or account management, whoever handles upsell, expansion, that sort of thing. But I think that product marketing, working with sales, providing deal support, providing enablement to sales, being a valued part of the sales team is one, it's going to help move the needle for the business. It's going to give you a very clear, measurable metric and impact metric that you can have around what product marketing is actually helping drive. But it's also, you're going to get a ton of valuable learnings and insights from working close with sales. So you're going to learn a lot from being involved in deals about why you're winning and losing against competitors. You're going to hear what is happening on calls. You're going to have so much like just valuable intel that will help fuel what Andy's always talking about, like everything that we're talking about with competitive market, buyer intelligence. If you're embedded within sales, don't be afraid of working with sales, get comfy with sales, be their best friend, and there's going to be a ton of value for product marketers.
What you're saying also aligns to like tomorrow's main hill, like product, if you think of product marketing as just marketing, then you don't do those things of talking to sales, talking to CS, talking to product, being that liaison and being that strategist for the whole company of like how product should be seen to our customers and our buyers or potential buyers. If you just in marketing, you only have access to really that distribution pod. Which product is, marketing is every distribution part that you can be touching. So that's why it's more of like a holistic strategy than just marketing in general. I'll ask Andy this because I know we're at time, but I just wanted you to give a quick rundown about your new show. I know Tamara talked about it a little bit, but like, why did you do the show and why are you only focusing on product launches?
Yeah. So Ready for Launch is a show where we'll have one theme per episode about product launches. So it might be like best launch of 2023, most controversial launch, best pre-internet launch. And then Jason, Tamara, and I will each come to the table with our pick for whatever best matches that topic. And then we'll debate on why we think that pick is best for that topic. And we did that. We're doing this for a few reasons. Number one, we are each like pretty strongly opinionated individuals. We have, I would say that like we have a lot of like strong opinions about like what is good, what's not good, what resonates with us, what we think did probably well for a company, why we don't like something. And so that makes for a good conversation. So we're not afraid to pull punches or anything like that. But then separately, it's also a competition. So we're all just trying to beat each other and convince each other that we actually brought to the table the more interesting launch or the launch that actually matches the topic the most. At the end of the day, we've just found that knowing and studying all these other companies that have gone through different launch variations, it's one of the best ways to up our own game. If we can know like what Apple has done in the past, what Nike has done in the past, what Tesla has done in the past, like all these like legendary companies or startups, like we just talked about Passion Fruit having like one of the best product launches of 2023, Passion Fruit, F-R-O-O-T. Anyway, studying all of these different companies and how they're going to market, how they're launching, it's the best way to like level up our individual games as well. And we feel like that's something that there wasn't really around for product marketers before this show. And so we want to use it to help everyone else level up and understand how other companies are launching things really successfully and differently too.
I know you're strong opinionated, but I know you are also competitive. So what is the score at right now of who's winning?
No, we're not going to talk about the score, Daniel. We're just going to, let's just leave it at that. And we'll wait till the end of the season. Let's wait till the end of the season, right, guys?
I'll wait to see the final score about it. But thank you so much for joining, and I appreciate it.
Thanks
for having us.
This is fun.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in next week to hear more great insights from marketing's coolest operators. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to the Marketing Millennials podcast and giving it a 5-star rating. It helps bring more marketers into our community.